your first Greenbelt or your first time in the Canopy venue. We've got so much great stuff going on. We've already had a dance this morning, which is why it's a little warmer in here than it might be outside. Our next is something very special. We've got a talk, which is not always that common on the Canopy stage. We've got Dave Randall, who's going to talk about the political power of music. Now, he's going to talk a bit about his book, and then there will be a chance for a Q&A. So if you do want to ask a question, there'll be a chance to come up, so make sure you talk into this microphone loudly and clearly for the recording. So let me introduce to you Dave Randall.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's an absolute pleasure to be at Greenbelt. Now, anyone who has had a quick flick through the book will know that Greenbelt has special significance for me. And I'm guessing whoever chose the last track has had a quick flick through the book, because it was at Greenbelt as a teenager that I first heard that tune, Free Nelson Mandela. And that really was an important moment for me. It was the first time when I felt music and politics converging in a very powerful way. And it set me on a journey. And the end result of, well, not the end result, but the one of the results so far is this book about music and politics that I'm here to talk with you about. I'm going to talk for about 25 minutes, and then I look forward to having a discussion with you all. So yeah, the book is about the political power of music. Now, it seems to me that anyone who wants to change the world must begin by answering two questions. One of them was most famously posed by the great soul singer Marvin Gaye, and the other by the Russian revolutionary Lenin. What's going on and what is to be done? So let's begin with what's going on. It seems to me that we are living through a period of political polarization, the likes of which I don't think I've seen before, certainly in my lifetime. It seems that millions of people all around the world are starting to question and indeed to reject the old so-called centre ground in politics. I've always thought that the centre ground is actually quite a misleading label. What we're actually talking about is that neoliberal economic consensus and all the policies associated with it. Millions of people are starting to reject that, and they're looking around for alternative ideas. Now, not only the Jeremy Corbyn phenomenon in Britain, but also the enthusiasm that greeted the Bernie Sanders campaign in America last year. Bernie Sanders, of course, somebody who described himself as a socialist and who was running on a ticket of increased social and economic justice in America. Also a guy who you might not have heard about, but there was a guy called Jean-Luc Mélenchon, another lefty who did very well in the French elections recently. There's Podemos in Spain. There was the Syriza government when they were first elected in Greece. All of these examples suggest to me that there is a huge potential audience for left-wing ideas, what I would call progressive ideas. I'm not going to make assumptions about everybody's politics. But where the left aren't making gains, or sometimes in parallel with those gains, the populist right and sometimes the far right are. And that is very worrying. So, what is to be done? There are, of course, many things that can and must be done to ensure that the progressive side of this period of polarization wins out, to ensure that we deliver a better world to future generations. I mean, in a sentence, I think it's incumbent on all of us to do what we can in terms of the struggle for a better world. We've all got to get stuck in whatever way that we can. Now, what I argue in the book is that one of the battlegrounds in this fight for a better world is culture. Because the images that we see every day, the stories that surround us, and the music that we experience all have, I think, a significant impact on the way that we feel about ourselves, each other, and the world that we share. We can have music that distracts us from the things that matter, music that stirs up tribalistic enmity, that marches us off to fight unnecessary and unjust wars. Or we can have music that brings together a broad range of people in a spirit of celebration, gives those people a bit of hope and confidence and an expanded sense of what's possible. So after more than two decades of working as a musician, mainly as a touring guitar player with different bands, I decided it was time for me to try to get to grips with this strange political power that I think music has. And as I say, the result is this book. One of the ideas that, or some of the ideas in the book, are influenced by a guy called Antonio Gramsci. He was actually an Italian Marxist. What I take from Gramsci is the idea that all culture is politically contested. It's not just elections that are politically contested. Everyday culture is as well. If you have any success at all with a piece of music, if you write a piece of music which resonates with an audience, then different people will try to pull its meaning or contextualize it in such a way that it suits their particular agenda. And of course, people with immense wealth and power are very good at this. But sometimes quite simple tricks can subvert things, achieving a different outcome. So all culture is politically contested, and I believe that the outcome of this contest matters. And actually, I think that we progressives would do well to recognise that. I think that compared to people with immense power and privilege, and indeed the state, I think we are playing catch-up. I think that they have understood the political power of culture for quite some time. You can probably all think of examples of the state shutting down music events. I'll give you a couple. Grime music has now broken through into the mainstream. You might have heard about some of the rising stars of grime. It was a hashtag #GrimeForCorbyn on Twitter that helped to revive the fortunes of the Labour Party at the last election. Ed Sheeran is desperate to be seen hanging out with the rising stars of grime, and one of them, Stormzy, has had a number one album and is now nominated for the Mercury Music Prize. So grime has really broken through into the mainstream, but not long before those things happened, grime gigs, certainly near where I live in Brixton in South London, they were routinely shut down by the police. And I think that's true across the capital. And actually, exactly the same thing happened in the early days of rave music. Have we got any old ravers in the tent? One. Good man. Two. You might remember that the Conservative government at that time, I think it was John Major by then, this was sort of mid-90s, the Conservative government at that time actually passed a piece of legislation which said that any gathering of over a certain number of people, I think it was 100 people, at which music characterised by repetitive beats is played, is now outlawed. That term, repetitive beats, actually entered into British law in 1994. Now, what the police will tell you is that they were simply responding to complaints about a disturbance to the peace. Nothing more to it than that. But I think something a little bit more fundamental was going on. I think that these were both scenes which worried the authorities. Because what you had in both these examples were large numbers of predominantly young working class people coming together to enjoy music, often in unsanctioned venues. This was not music that had come from the corporate mainstream music industry. It most certainly hadn't been commissioned by the state. I think the authorities felt that they didn't understand it. They were worried they couldn't control it, and so they decided that they had to shut it down. Now, what I discovered when I started to do some research for the book is that this sort of suspicious, antagonistic relationship between an establishment and the music preferred by large numbers of ordinary people, that this sort of relationship has been going on for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And therefore, just to make sure that our discussion has a proper sense of historical perspective, I want to give you an example, if I may, from 12th century Europe, where the establishment The establishment at that time was composed of the popes and the abbots of the Catholic Church and the feudal lords. That was the establishment in Europe at the time. And this was an establishment who were very fearful that ordinary people might rise up and demand a better lot in life. Conditions for most of us back in the days of feudalism would have been pretty grim, after all. And therefore, what the establishment did was that they peddled quite aggressively the message that the social order itself, the social order, is ordained by God. The implication, of course, being that any attempt to change the social order was not only futile, but blasphemous. So don't even think about it. And they used music to reinforce this message. They commissioned composers to compose music, which they hoped would encourage congregations to quietly gaze upward in spiritual contemplation. And they banned any music which they thought might get those same people thinking about other things, about worldly pleasures and so on. Now, repetitive beats weren't yet a problem, but the establishment decided that certain combinations of notes were certain intervals, as we musicians call them. In fact, famously, I'm sure some of you know about this, the most difficult, the most dissonant sounding combination of two notes, the most unsettling sounding interval, are there any musicians who know the musical term for it? Yeah, close enough. Yeah, augmented fourth, diminished fifth, tritone. There's a few different names for the same sound. The establishment at the time described this particular interval as diabolus in musica, the devil in music. Now, for the non-musicians, I've brought my guitar along so that you can hear this diabolic sound. Prepare to be scared. By the way, never judge a guitarist by the size of their amplifier. The crew guys were laughing at me earlier. So here we go. The augmented fourth, diminished fifth, tritone, or diabolus in musica. Here we go. Pretty scary stuff, eh? The truth, of course, is that our ideas have changed and the sound is now familiar to us because it's been used a lot in music in the intervening centuries. There's lots of examples of this. Have you got the guitar out front, by the way? You can hear it? Okay, great. One of my favourites is the Jimi Hendrix song Purple Haze, the intro to that. Let me just dial in some gain on the amp. Because, you see, Jimmy was playing a B-flat octave. But the bass player was playing an E. So what you heard was the diabolic interval. Oh, don't patronise me. It's also right near the beginning of the theme tune to The Simpsons. Between the and the sim, any Simpsons fans? But I digress. Anyway, this sound was completely taboo, completely out of bounds for official state-sponsored composers. But not only that, even the sweet-sounding bedrock of Western musical harmony, the third, even this sound was forbidden. Even that. You can bring it down in the monitor, by the way. I don't need more. I was just making sure you had it. Even that was forbidden. Now, what do you think ordinary people did about these restrictions? Anyone want to hazard a guess? Ignored them, precisely. Precisely. And therefore, away from the cathedrals, on the street corners, in the taverns, in the marketplaces, precisely the sound of thirds moving in parallel became popular. This sort of thing. except it wouldn't have been played on a guitar. It would have typically been two voices or two copper horns called lurs. They were very popular at the time. The lur is noteworthy, actually, because it's the only instrument that I know of, at least, that has a butter named after it, Lurpak. It's true. You're going to remember this talk while you're in the supermarket next week, and you're going to seek out the Lurpak butter, and you'll see the logo has the lur. So this was, if you will, the rave or the grime of its time, loved by the people, loathed by their rulers. And this musical standoff lasted for some 200 years until famine swept across Europe with plague in its wake. Conditions for ordinary people became completely unbearable, and so they did rise up. They started to set fire to the chateau of the feudal lords. They started to refuse to pay money to the Catholic Church and to the feudal lords, which they had been compelled to do until that point. And so the establishment faced a real crisis. They were more keen than ever before to peddle the message that the social order is ordained by God, but they realized that that had become a pill too bitter for most people to swallow. And so, eventually and somewhat reluctantly, they agreed to sweeten it by accepting some popular innovations, including those in musical harmony. This was the beginning of the European Renaissance. You could at last use thirds in official church music. Now, that really set the stage for the whole canon of Western classical music that would follow. But you see this sort of thing happening time and time again. You see establishments who are fundamentally distrustful of and somewhat afraid of ordinary people, and who, as a result of that, try to control and restrict the music of ordinary people. And you see ordinary people coming up with innovative ways to get around those restrictions. Given that it's August bank holiday weekend, we're all happy to be at Greenbelt, but I would also be happy to be with my friends at the Notting Hill Carnival, which of course starts tomorrow. I want to give you a carnival-related example of this. Now, the Notting Hill Carnival has its roots in the Trinidadian Carnival. And Trinidad still has one of the biggest, and in my opinion, one of the best carnivals in the world. If ever you get the chance to go to Trinidad at carnival time, seize the opportunity. You're going to love it. Carnival in Trinidad, by the way, is just before Lent, same as everywhere else in the world other than Notting Hill. You're going to love it. Now, most people quite enjoy carnival. Most people quite enjoy carnival. 150 years ago, the British colonial authority in Trinidad hated it. They saw it as a powerful symbolic challenge to their authority, and they decided it had to stop. It's exactly what they tried to do in 1881. Captain Baker and his troops went charging in with truncheons flying, but the carnival goers fought back. The clashes went on for several hours. Eventually, the police and the troops were pushed back, and carnival was saved. It's now celebrated in Trinidad as the Camboulay Riot of 1881. That word, by the way, Camboulay, that's what carnival was called at the time. And when I was in Trinidad asking around, most people seem to think that the word comes from the French can brûlée, meaning burnt cane. Because what would happen is the carnival goers would set fire to the sugar cane, the crop which for many of them would have represented their oppression, and they would march into town in celebration. So, as you can imagine, the rulers were none too pleased. Their attempts to stop carnival had been thwarted. There was too much popular resistance. They needed a new strategy. They came up with one just 2 years later, 1883. They decided, okay, there's too much resistance to the idea of banning carnival outright. What we'll do instead is ban its musical heart. Now, its musical heart, back in the 1880s, was like a djembe-style skin drum. They banned drums. Now, the Trinidadian musicians are a resourceful lot. Their attitude was this: okay, you've banned drums, we'll simply find an alternative. And they found that alternative growing in abundance all around them on the islands of Trinidad and Tobago. Bamboo. They realized that if you got a length of bamboo and banged it on the floor and then hit it with a stick, you got a pretty good approximation of a drum sound. I've got a little video. It doesn't matter that you won't be able to see it. It's more the sound that I want you to hear. But I've got a little video of a modern day reenactment of this bamboo group phenomenon. So let me just play you a little bit so you can hear the sound of bamboo. And if you can see it, so much the better. So bamboo became the new sound of carnival. Once again, as you can imagine, the rulers were none too pleased. Their attempts this time to derail carnival had been gotten around. And so they started to pass legislation. They'd already banned the wearing of masks. They now said that you can't dance in a certain profane way. You can't sing certain songs, particularly songs that are rude about the ruling classes. And then in the 1930s, they banned bamboo. They used the outbreak of the Second World War to agree a temporary stop to carnival. And that allowed the Trinidadian musicians to get together once again, particularly in the poor parts of east of Port of Spain. They got together and they thought to themselves, okay, you've banned drums, now you've banned bamboo, what are we going to use next? And they noticed that the American Navy, who had leased large parts of the island during the Second World War, was starting to litter the island with a huge number of oil drums. Most of you seem to know where this story is going. By Trinidad's Victory in Europe celebrations in 1945, something very similar to the now much loved tuned steel pan was revealed to amazed revelers. The very existence of the instrument underlines our indefatigable desire to express ourselves through music, even when we're facing quite harsh political repression. I look at a few other case studies in the book. I talk about the way that music was used by the dictators of the 20th century. I talk about the way that music was used by the CIA during the Cold War. I tell the rather disturbing story of the Romanian-born Greek composer, Yanis Xenakis. I won't have time to get into that this morning. Coming into the 21st century, I talk about the significance, as I see it, of shows like Pop Idol, X Factor, The Voice. I talk about the significance, as I see it, of the growth in popularity of music festivals, including Greenbelt, of course. I talk about Beyoncé and her nod of solidarity towards the Black Lives Matter movement last year when she performed Formation in the way that she did at the Super Bowl. And I also talk about the Arab revolutions of 2010-2011. And the last little story that I would like to share with you during this introductory talk before we have a discussion, the last story I'd like to share comes from that chapter, because I think it's kind of an important story. The chapter begins, as the short-lived Arab Spring did. It begins in Tunisia, and it ends in Syria. And in Syria, we find a full-voiced firefighter and part-time poet, a guy called Ibrahim al-Kashoush, singing in the town square in Hama, one of the big cities in Syria. And he's singing a song that he's written in a traditional Levantine folk form, a call and response form, perfect for asserting political demands. I've got a bit of footage. Again, it doesn't matter that most of you won't be able to see my little laptop from where you're sitting. There is a translation which, you, as I say, most of you won't be able to read, but it's fairly predictable stuff. Every single line is laying into the regime of Bashar al-Assad, and the the refrain, the hook that people chant back is "Get out, Bashar." The footage was taken just on somebody's phone in the square on the 27th. This was the 27th of June 2011. So have a quick look at this. Those of you down the front, you know, you might be able to make out some of the translation. I'll just play you a quick excerpt so you can hear the tune. So Bashar al-Assad singing in the town square in Hama, Syria. Okay. Ibrahim al-Kashush singing on the 27th of June 2011. Now, those of you who are at the front may have noticed that one of the lines translated is the singer describing Bashar as an ass. And it's important to me that the information that I give you in these sorts of talks is as accurate as possible, and therefore I want to share with you a correction that was told to me by a native Arabic speaker from the region when I did a book event in West London recently. Apparently, a better translation of that particular word is fart. So I just want you to know that. So, that piece of footage taken on the mobile phone on the 27th of June 2011. The regime responded quite quickly. Just a few days later, on the 4th of July, the body of Ibrahim al-Kashush washed up on the shores of the Orontes River. And it was quite clear from the way in which he'd been murdered that he had been murdered precisely because of the performance that we just saw. I felt that it was important to include that story in the book because some people have said to me, Dave, music doesn't really change the world. The most that musicians ever do is provide a soundtrack while other people go out and try to change the world. And very often that's true. Very often that is the best that musicians offer. But what the music of the Arab revolutions reminds us of is that sometimes music and musicians have been absolutely central to critical moments of mass struggle. They have helped to bring confidence to long oppressed people. They have helped to cohere people around a set of political demands. And some of them have paid the highest possible price for their courage. I'm going to start to wrap up this introductory talk, but let me say this. The book isn't just a series of case studies. I do try to draw out the threads which run through each of them and to arrive at some conclusions. And therefore, the penultimate chapter is my Rebel Music Manifesto. A set of ideas, really, a set of suggestions about the sorts of things we might want to think about doing in order to make sure that music enriches the lives of all of us rather than just lines the pockets of the few. I've tried to make the book as entertaining and as accessible as possible. I do actually want people to, you know, to have a read and to let me know what they think. I mean, ideally, I would like my book to be my small contribution to what I hope can become a much broader conversation about this stuff, because it seems to me that the more that we try and get our heads around, the more that we talk about the political power of culture, the better that we understand the mechanisms at work, the more likely we are to be able to effectively intervene and get something better the better place we will be to start to create the kind of culture that I think that we deserve and that we badly need at the moment. And so I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts about all this stuff. But for now, I want to thank you very much for listening to me so respectfully. Thank you. So I can't remember, that's the mic, is it, that people need to come up to. So just if anyone has any thoughts, questions, comments.
I missed the first few minutes, so I don't know if you defined what you mean by political, but one thing that someone challenged me on a good few years ago now, when I was talking about a particular band that I was into that I considered political, but they were playing stadiums, and he said, well, Martin, like, is it more political to play like your local community centre or your local school than it is to sort of play a stadium? And I'm a bit cynical about sort of like people like Stormzy. I don't really consider it to be that political because I'm sure the guy has got like 50 pairs of Nike or Adidas sneakers, and most of his fans will be supporting like capitalism through consumerism, through all like the bling and stuff. So I was wondering if you got any comments. I'm not like criticizing. I think, you know, your talk was really good. I was just wondering if you've got any comments on that sort of stuff and what, you know, what we really consider to be political.
Yeah. Okay. So let me unpack that all a little bit. I mean, one of the very good points that you raise is whether politics is most effective at a community level or in stadiums, as you put it, when it's coming from artists. Well, I think you do what you can where you can. My Rebel Music Manifesto begins by saying that music in communities is extremely important. And one of the examples I touch upon in the book is the example of Rock Against Racism, which steered the common sense of this country towards anti-racism at a time when that wasn't inevitable. You had Eric Clapton drunk on stage at the Birmingham Odeon, 1976, going on this dreadful racist rant. But the context was this. You'd already had David Bowie, again, probably high or drunk or something, but nonetheless saying that Adolf Hitler, he considered Adolf Hitler to be one of the world's first rock stars or some such words. You had Rod Stewart saying that he felt that the country was full up. You had punks flirting with the imagery, at least, of the far right, including the swastika. This was the context in the late 70s. Rock Against Racism came along, and it did two things, and it did them very effectively. It put on the biggest possible gigs it could with some of the biggest stars in the genres that they thought were most relevant, which was punk and reggae. That's what they believe are the most relevant genres. So they put on huge events, Victoria Park in London, Brockwell Park in South London, and across the country. And some of the, you know, some fairly big stars played at them. So The Clash, Aswad, Elvis Costello, and so on. But what they also did was they encouraged people to put on small gigs in their local community centre, in their local church hall. They encouraged people at the grassroots to you know, put on Rock Against Racism gigs, and they provided the information. They provided a free sheet called, I don't know if it was free actually, but a fanzine called Temporary Hoarding with the politics and so on. So they operated at both levels, and I think that's what we have to do. Wherever you are, there's something you can do to campaign against racism, to campaign against austerity, whatever, to campaign for better policies around climate change. I mean, whatever it is that interests you, there are things that you can do wherever you are. Now, it's rare for the hugest stadium-filling rock stars to sort of bother with progressive politics. I think it's rare, but it does happen. I talk about the Beyoncé example. I think that when she referenced the Black Lives Matter movement in that performance, I think that was useful. I think that gave the movement of the streets, the grassroots movement, some publicity. It would have provoked some conversations about that movement, and therefore I think it was helpful for her to do that. One other example of an artist who I think consistently makes the effort to stay in touch with political campaigns and political organisations, and as a result keeps doing quite useful things politically, in my view, is Bruce Springsteen. I think he's another person who sort of makes the effort to stay in touch with what people are concerned about, but most of them don't. So I think you do what you can where you can. On the question of Stormzy, I think that if you look at the statements that he's made on stage, and indeed the tweets, he's in interviews he's been very very clear that he supports Jeremy Corbyn. He was brilliant in his statement of solidarity with the victims of Grenfell recently. You know, a whole number of things. He talks about the idea that we have to question this sort of inherited situation where this small number of people have such disproportionate power over our lives. I mean, that's something that he's picked up in interviews on a few occasions. So I respectfully disagree. I think that Stormzy is pretty political in quite an exciting way. And I know, I absolutely know this wasn't your intention, but let me just add a footnote. I do think that black artists in particular are disproportionately criticised for the fashion choices they make and the lifestyles that they are perceived to be living. So we should be cautious about criticising the number of trainers that you assume Stormzy has. I mean, I think we need to look at the bigger picture and the bigger context. And I would argue that Stormzy is a very exciting, principled young artist.
Is there a bit of a paradox here? We may complain about the authorities trying to shut down certain forms of music, but actually isn't that the very best promotion you can have, to be shut down by the police? So should we welcome it, in fact?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly can help to give some support to a particular song or indeed to a particular artist. And I think that's very interesting, because what it suggests is that when the state singles out a particular song or a particular artist to be sanctioned in some way, to be censored or, you know, in some way suppressed, lots of people suddenly jump in behind that artist and the song shoots up the chart. I think that's rather exciting. It's a little small indication of the rebellious spirit inside most of us. So I actually welcome the fact that it can be a help. I mean, but it depends on the context. I mean, in some contexts, the stakes are very, very high. I mean, generally, when artists make a political statement, they pay some sort of a price. Now, artists in the audience shouldn't be put off. I think it's incredibly important. It's something else I argue in the book, is that if you want to make overtly political music, if you want to, you don't have to, you know. It's perfectly okay to talk about other things, in my opinion. But if you want to make overtly political music, I say go for it. But you will make one or two enemies. And there are many examples of political statements adversely affecting careers. I mean, one I talk about in the book is when the Dixie Chicks, live on stage at the Shepherd's Bush Empire, said that they agreed with the people protesting on the streets of Europe that the Iraq war was a bad idea. This was about a week before the war started. They said, we support the protesters and we're embarrassed that our president comes from Texas. They're proud Texans, these women. Well, of course, it got a big cheer in London, but when the comments were reported in America, gigs were cancelled, their record sales started to bomb, there were sort of campaigns to boycott them on radio stations, and it absolutely trashed their careers commercially, for a while at least. They issued an apology, they were so freaked out, but by then the commercial damage was done. And actually, in a sense, they were made an example of, because then other artists, even some of the biggest, started to self-censor. Madonna actually was due to have a video come out, American Life, which was very anti-war, believe it or not, and you can still find it on the internet. It ended with her throwing a hand grenade at a George W. Bush lookalike, this video. Well, when she saw what happened to the Dixie Chicks, she pulled that video and shot a new one that was completely bland and completely sanitized. I feel like I've got... What was your... Yeah, what's my point? My point is, I welcome the fact that it helps artists when it helps artists, but let's be clear, artists almost always take a risk by getting political, and we should support them and send our solidarity to them. We shouldn't assume that they are doing it. I'm not suggesting you were suggesting this, but some people sometimes suggest that artists get political simply to sell records. I think that's very, very seldom the case. Somebody over there. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. You and then you.
Yeah. So based on your talk, we're talking about politics as it stands today and for the last couple of hundred years or so.
Yeah.
But what about music that is generated from oppression out of slavery or apartheid, which in essence, politics is about life. So what do you think about that? I mean, it doesn't have to be commercial. It's just something that bonds the people together under a certain condition that helps them to survive that condition, as it were, until change can come.
Well, there's one very striking example of this, which actually isn't in the book. I mean, it didn't make the final edit. I didn't feel that I had space to do it justice. I didn't want the book to become too long. So it didn't end up being one of the case studies. But on the specific question of music and slavery, there was an example that I learned about, which I found fascinating. People talk about the songs that were communally sung in the fields where slaves were working, particularly in the south of the USA, the songs that were sung. It turns out, or at least there's compelling evidence to suggest, that the reason why the idea of singing songs together became popular is because it set a tempo. And the important thing about working at a tempo is that you set a tempo which everyone can keep up with, because prior to that, anyone falling behind would be physically attacked by the thugs overseeing them. So this was precisely a technique, in a very concrete way, precisely a technique to survive that appalling situation. So what you find is that music and life, as you put it, including some of the most grotesque manifestations of life, are always intimately linked, either as a way of surviving life, and I talk about this in a very different context as well. I talk about it in the context of the sort of loneliness and alienation that many of us feel. You know, even living in countries like Britain today, many of us, I think, feel unfulfilled and so on. And I think that music lets us know, like all great art, I suppose, it lets us know that we are not alone, that we're not the only one experiencing those feelings. And therefore, it helps us to endure alienation. At its best, though, to paraphrase Leonard Cohen, at its best, music prizes open the cracks that let in the light, illuminating the path to a better world. So at its best, music also becomes a tool of resistance and a tool for progress, political progress.
Sorry, I'm too short. You've talked a lot about music and the authorities wanting to shut it down, but there's a second route that authorities sometimes take of co-option of the musical style. Is that something that people who are interested in the power of politics to change, the power of music and political music to change culture, need to be aware of and be watching out for, do you think?
Absolutely. I'm pleased you've asked that. I mean, it goes back to one of the points I made early on in the talk, which is that all culture is politically contested. Now, what that means concretely is that, yes, backwards elements in society will, for various reasons, try to co-opt and use music to their own ends. There's absolutely no question. I mean, sometimes this takes very dramatic forms. So, for example, both Hitler and Stalin recruited composers directly because they recognised that music was so important in terms of winning hearts and minds. And interestingly, a little aside, Stalin had a very complicated relationship with one of his chosen composers, Dmitri Shostakovich, precisely because Shostakovich threw in too many dissonant sounds, too many of those diabolic intervals. And this was a problem for Stalin, because what Stalin wanted, and Hitler was very similar in this regard, what they wanted was music that sounded like how they wanted their subjects to feel, how they wanted to think, at least, that their subjects were feeling. So they wanted these themes of, you know, conquest and pride and all that sort of bombast in the music. And when Shostakovich threw in a few dissonant sounds, a few unsettling sounds, Stalin suddenly wasn't sure what side he was really on. And there was an editorial in Pravda, the state newspaper, a review of a production by Shostakovich, entitled Muddle Instead of Music. It complains about too many dissonant sounds in the music, and it concludes with the chilling words, "If Shostakovich doesn't change his ways, things may end very badly for him." Shostakovich understood what was meant by that. He withdrew his fourth symphony, which was already in production. He wrote a much more musically conservative fifth symphony. But some people don't think he was completely cowed, because if you listen to the closing bars of that fifth symphony, they are so formulaic. They are so sort of, the bombast is so predictable. They are so pedestrian for a composer as talented as him, that lots of people, when they listen to that, what they hear is sarcasm. You know, that really this is the equivalent of a backside bed at the Politburo. But that's an aside. I think the more significant form of co-option for us is the way that music is used in film soundtracks, TV soundtracks, and of course in advertising. I think in a sense that's the most insidious, is that the right word? I mean, that's the most insidious form of co-option at the moment. We're persuaded, we're pulled emotionally in a particular direction by the music, even though the music has absolutely no correlation very often with the product on sale in the advert. It's fundamentally dishonest. The great music producer Quincy Jones referred to music as the emotion lotion. You just pour it on something and that thing seems much more desirable or much more scary or whatever. And therefore, it is on a sort of subtle, often subconscious, but nonetheless very powerful sense, it is in a very powerful sense, part of the sort of campaign, either to make a product seem desirable that really isn't, or perhaps to make a Hollywood film's version of history seem more plausible or more moving and so on. And so you have to examine that. I think you have to examine the ways in which we are being manipulated very often by music and persuaded to take seriously narratives that actually we should pick apart and question.
Thank you very much, Dave. Let's give it up for Dave Randall.